Hi there, I'm Alistair Madden and you're listening to Season 5, Episode 17 of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. In this episode, we were joined by Ninad Barbidiker to survey the current Bundesliga landscape and spotlight three players who look well positioned to shape the final seven match days of the current campaign. Elsewhere, we critiqued Lazio's decision to appoint Igor Tudor as their new manager, and we looked ahead to Saturday night's intriguing Copa del Rey final between Athletic Club and Real Mallorca. We looked at all of those topics and so much more in our usual detailed way. Do check out the show notes for a comprehensive running order. This episode is, of course, produced in partnership with Freelance Football Ops. If any of our listeners are freelancing in football, you may be interested in signing up to Freelance Football Ops' subscription-based newsletter. They find jobs which cover writing, design, video, audio, and generally anything in football media every week. For more info, visit freelancefootballops.com or follow at FFOps on Twitter. Right, on now with the episode. Hopefully you're all staying safe. Hopefully you're all staying well. Thanks, as always, for your continued support. Enjoy. Well, dear listener, welcome back to another episode of the Road to Nowhere European Football Podcast. Rudy Barlow will join us in due course. He is currently in Granada, which is all right for some, particularly when we consider the quite brutal weather in Glasgow right now. Michael, I'm not sure. Michael Jones, I'm not sure if it's any better down in Manchester. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. I wouldn't say it's as bad as that, but it's nice to be recording with a bit of daylight. I've got a skylight above me and it rarely comes into use when we're podcasting. But yeah, it's in full force today. What about you, Ali?
Yeah, I'm very well, Michael. I had a lovely Easter weekend with the family, ate a lot of chocolate and feeling very much recharged and ready to go for the next couple of months, I guess. I've got a week off in April, actually, which will be lovely. Ready to go for another busy couple of months before heading off to Germany to watch Scotland in the Euro, spending a couple of weeks in Köln and Düsseldorf. But anyway, in the meantime, Michael, I think what we should do is we should look at what's been happening in Serie A, where Igor Tudor is back and in some style to taking the helm at Lazio. The Croat guided his side to a memorable 1-0 win over Juventus in his first game. Despite a somewhat mixed tenure at Marseille, it's felt for a while like a case of when rather than if the former Hellas Verona boss would be appointed by one of Calcio's seven sisters. But do we think Lazio are a good fit for Tudor's skills and ambitions, Michael?
Well, I think compared to Sarri, I think it's a very good fit. And that might be a damning indictment on Maurizio Sarri, which I'll get onto in a moment. But I think this Igor Tudor appointment is really exciting. I mean, Lazio can be a notoriously vociferous club, but as we both know very well, Ali, he experienced that to the maximum, I guess you'd say, last season at Marseille. And yeah, I think there's a sense of disappointment and underwhelmment when he departed. I know he led them back into Champions League. Well, they were in Champions League football, but he led them to Champions League football again, but it cited fatigue at the end of the season. I think with the atmosphere and environment which he had to work within, but despite that, had some real success during that time. But then I think it was Annecy. He had that really bad cup upset. There was the Tottenham Hotspur game, the last one at the group stage, where I remember watching that game live, and there was a sense of naivety to that performance where Tottenham scored two last-minute goals. And you can look at them and you can question whether Tudor is right. And you could be thinking, what are you on about, Michael? Why on earth is he a good fit to replace Maurizio Sarri, of all people, in Lazio? But the work he'd done at Hellas Verona, in his brief stints at Udinese before then, or also in Turkey, proving that Igor Tudor is a really flexible, a really exciting a really bold coach. And I think that kind of injection of bravery and energy and obvious tactical acumen is something that Lazio have really been missing with Sarri. And I've very much been umming and ahhing with Maurizio Sarri so far this season, up until the point that he left, as to whether he could steer the ship in the right direction for Lazio. Obviously, he got them into the top four last season. He navigated them through the Champions League group stage this season, but there was a real lack of consistency in the league. And I think what made that more alarming was the fact that Sarri wasn't able to capitalize. You know, he could attribute his failings a bit in the first season or shortcomings, albeit they weren't too bad, to the lack of new players and new arrivals, both on and off the pitch. But he was certainly provided that by Claudio Lotito, the club's owner, during the summer. And we saw the arrivals of Daichi Kamada, Matteo Guendouzi, Valentin Castellanos, to name a few. And he just couldn't get a tune out of any of them, really. And I think that was a really worrying sign. And I think I always thought Sarri had the ability to turn it around, but I was always thinking back to what he'd done during his time at Napoli rather than what he'd probably done at his successive stints at Chelsea, then Juventus. And I think we kind of saw an even weakened version of Sarri after that. And I think that has maybe given people a false impression as to how weak this Lazio squad is. Obviously, people will remember they beat Bayern Munich recently 1-0. So it shouldn't be a huge shock that Igor Tudor was able to get a reaction and beat an out-of-form Juventus team, which I'm sure we'll get to speak about at some point very soon. But what you could see in that performance alone was a huge injection of energy on the pitch. There was really quick passing movements, a lot of one-touch play, both in the middle and final third. There were bodies flooding the box. I mean, Valentin Castellanos was picked over Ciro Immobile. Huge sign of confidence from the man who came from Girona, who I'm sure has had one of the most regrettable transfers up until this point so far this season. But he has got that trust from the manager to be maybe the man going forwards. And although he didn't score, he had a number of chances that threatened Juventus, albeit wasn't able to get them on target, but his positional play was quite impressive. And the fact that he was able to create these chances against one of the most established defences in Serie A this season certainly brings confidence. And I think one of the final things that I think is really exciting is, along with these kind of new players like Kamado and Guendouzi provided the assist for Marusic. And I think that's a really nice segue into this final point, because Guendouzi being one of those newer players who hasn't really had consistent success during his time at Lazio, and it should be stressed he came off the bench during this game, setting up Marusic, who the Montenegrin's been a really well-established Serie A player for a number of years, but really enjoyed his heyday under Simone Inzaghi, working in a 3-5-2 system as one of the wing-backs or as one of the centre-backs, did really well playing both roles, and kind of felt a bit like he was put in a corner, or what's the expression, he's kind of put in a box by Maurizio Sarri in terms of his attributes, and that he wasn't able to express himself in a more conventional 4-3-3. And although Tudor reversed between kind of a 3-4-3 that he utilised a lot at Marseille and a 4-4-2 at times, Marusic did have that freedom, and it was displayed when he made a late run in the dying seconds of the game to steer an emphatic header home for his first goal of the season. And I think that first goal from Marusic can be really symbolic. We shouldn't forget that they have had Lazzari on the books. He'd be another player who'd be really relishing this kind of change as well. But, you know, Luis Alberto was on the bench, so was Ciro Immobile, so was Matias Vecino, some key players. And I think there's a real sense of bravery from Tudor already. And I think he'll be looking to do that until the end of the season. And you get the impression he's put these players on an even keel, and he said, look, I'm going to be here next season, whether you like it or not. Prove to me what you've got. And I think it's going to, you know, these players are now playing for their future. Lotito can be quite a stingy owner, so he won't be wanting to waste any players or have anybody sort of staying around who's not going to be a part of the project. And although it is only just over a year project, there's very reasonable achievements within that contract, which allows it to be triggered. I think it's just any kind of European football which triggers an automatic one-year extension. So Tudor, you'd hope, unlike in the south of France, is here to stay. And I think the fans will warm to his kind of demeanour, his personality. So yeah, really exciting times, and what a performance to get it started.
You mentioned Juventus and their struggles, Michael. It has been a recurring theme for the Bianconeri in 2024, with their title hopes in tatters, having won just one of their past 9 games. How have the wheels fallen off so spectacularly, and what does this mean for Massimiliano Allegri?
Yeah, all the optimism has gone in Turin now, and what it means for Allegri is a really important point, because unless he's able to turn something around really quickly and kind of cover the what's been an abysmal start to the season that's kind of ruined any title hopes and could potentially leave their the Champions League hopes in jeopardy if they're not able to rescue it soon, it remains yet to be seen. But yeah, the wheels have just completely fallen off of the Bianconeri. And I think one of the reasons was, and I think, you know, to try and provide a balanced opinion to this, is that Allegri and Juventus had spectacularly overachieved in keeping pace with Inter Milan this season. This was a squad where at least the starting 11 for large periods of time was a fraction of the budget of Inter Milan's, both in terms of wage and transfer fees. They were also, everybody knows about Paul Pogba, but we shouldn't forget Nicolò Fagioli, like we spoke a lot about last season. He got caught up in the scandal alongside Sandro Tonali, so he's suspended for the whole season as well. But they've had a number of injuries. I think this was 27 games into the season now, I think, off the top of my head, and none of the players have started more than 20, none of the attacking players have started more than 20 games. So there's not been that regularity for Dusan Vlahovic, Moise Kean, Federico Chiesa. And, you know, Vlahovic, in fairness to him, has scored 15 goals this season, but he has been one of the more expensive outlays during Allegri's tenure. He only scored 10 league goals last season. And although he's done better this season, a lot of that better form has come whilst Juventus have been struggling more. They had a really damning defeat to Napoli only a few weeks ago, and this was a similar one, really. I thought Lazio were by far the better team. Lazio dominated the game at the Stadio Olimpico. Juventus were just unable to exert any real control and were just kind of relying on their defensive resilience, which I think was breached a number of times very easily. And it just seems that the kind of against the odds mentality, the sense of togetherness in this Juventus team is falling apart very quickly. And if you strip this team kind of to its bare assets and a team that has been underinvested in over the last few years, there is a lot of potential, but there is, you know, potential is the word. And in terms of ready-made quality for a team of Juventus's stature or to make a considerable impact in the Champions League next season, with Allegri's kind of suffer ball style, where that itself even seems to be a bit of a dying breed with managers. You know, Antonio Conte has been out of work, I think, for about a year now. I think it was this time last April he lost his job. And, you know, Mourinho is another man who has been out of work for a few months, and you don't know how long that could be as well in the near future. And that kind of breed of managers are ones that do seem to be struggling more when there is so many emerging young coaches. Thiago Motta has been really strongly linked with the role next season. And if you look at the core of Juventus' squad, there is an exciting element to it. There is a lot of these young players, but for how long will they want to continue to play Allegri's style of play, even though he is a bit of a mentor to them, especially if it's not bringing the results? So yeah, I think this is maybe the beginning of the end And for Allegri this season. We've said it a couple of times before that it could be, but I think this time I'm pretty confident that it will be, even if he is able. I mean, it's important to stress Juventus have Lazio tonight in the cup in a two-legged affair in the semi-finals. So, you know, they may well end up with silverware and a Champions League trophy, but with the emergence of several up-and-coming, hugely exciting managerial prospects, not even discussing Xabi Alonso, but Ruben Amorim, Thiago Motta, a couple there, you can look in Italy for further examples like Vincenzo Italiano. It seems a really risky time for them to maybe stick with Allegri when they could be missing out on a huge opportunity for the team to move forwards again, especially if they do want to do things on the cheap. But yeah, I don't think this has been a disastrous spell by Allegri by any means. I think there's, you know, he steered them to top four finishes, even though if points deductions not meant they've always actually technically ended the season there. But unfortunately, I think their resources have been stretched, and I think it's really taken a toll on the players physically and mentally now. And I think Yeah, it's now the kind of time where Juventus should be eyeing up managerial candidates to succeed Allegri.
Elsewhere, there was a huge sense of sadness overshadowing the match between Fiorentina and AC Milan. La Viola's president, Joe Baroni, died aged just 57 after suffering a cardiac arrest in the team hotel prior to the club's game with Atalanta last month. Tell us more about Joe and the footballing legacy he leaves behind, Michael.
I mean, Joe Barone's impressions as a person, not just his kind of sporting success, which I'll get onto in a moment with Fiorentina, is really one that should be well remembered by football fans, not just in Italy, but that he'll be really fondly remembered in the US as well. And yeah, Barone actually was part of the Rococomiso takeover of the club back in 2019. He'd worked with Camiso previously at New York Cosmos. And if anybody's followed Camiso's journey through football and how he ended up at Fiorentina, he had been a pioneer for football in the US from the 1970s. He's 74 now and he's still running the club. But yeah, he'd been supported heavily both at New York Cosmos and at Fiorentina by Joe Baroni, who's actually Giuseppe Baroni, but always goes by Joe, and the kind of outpouring of tributes, not just in Italian football, but from further afield, were truly outstanding. There was Marco Messina, he's a journalist for CBS Sports Galazzo and founder of Italian Football TV. And he had a really special relationship with Joe Baroni. He was one of the people who went with Joe Baroni used to drive Marco and his and Joe's son to football every week before Joe started doing interviews with him in Serie A. And yeah, there's a really nice clip of them on Facebook where he's offered to take him to one of the games and let him stay at his after covering a Fiorentina match for CBS as well. But yeah, there's numerous interviews that you can find of Barone online, and part of the reason of that was that he was the face of a lot of Laviola's success, and that includes Laviola Park, which is one of the biggest training grounds and one of the most spectacular ones I've ever seen, but certainly in Italian football. And I'm sure people are aware that one of the huge problems, anyone who's listened to this podcast, I guess, for the last 6 months to a year or longer, one of the repeated issues that resurfaces and what that's led to the stagnation of Italian football from all the way back from the 90s has been that lack of investment in infrastructure. And that's something that Baroni's really put at the heart of what he's done. And it's coincided with a really successful period. He also had a big role in the scouting with Daniel Brate. And he was also there overlooking Joe in his dying moments before his family arrived at the hospital just a day before his 58th birthday as well. So it was a really, really touching tributes. Tributes were taken before the match against AC Milan and also on the Laviola Park as well. And yeah, you really hope that he has left a firm and brilliant legacy. Obviously, they've still got some very important figures running things at the club, but he was one of the ones who was really involved in the day-to-day. He certainly had a really humane side to him that I think not just players and fans, but yeah, people in the media were able to relate to as well. And not just for the growth of Italian football in Europe, but especially in America, Baroni has been absolutely massive. And in a time where these leagues are relying ever more on, international markets in order to just secure their future as a competitive league, Baroni has been absolutely pivotal to that in the last few years. And I guess it's a shame that Fiorentina weren't able to win the Conference League in front of him last season, but my word, they've got a great chance of being able to do it this year as well. So yeah, I mean, I always root for Fiorentina anyway, if that's never come through what I've said, but I'll be doing it ever more so for the rest of this campaign.
Lovely stuff, Michael. Lovely stuff indeed. Okay, we are going to draw to a close our analysis of Italian football. There are plenty of interesting developments and, yeah, some really quite sad news off the field of play. We are going to dial in Ninad now. Ninad is going to talk us through the final few game weeks of the Bundesliga season. We're going to spotlight some players who look well positioned to shape those final few game weeks. We'll be right back. In Germany, the league table is shaping up rather beautifully as we approach the business end of the season. With 7 match days to go, pretty much everything is still to play for, from the title race, just about anyway, to the push for Europe, all the way down to the battle to avoid relegation to the second tier. To survey the current landscape and spotlight three players who look well positioned to shape the final few weeks of the campaign, I'm delighted to be joined by a friend of the podcast, Ninad Berbidikar. Ninad, it's great to have you on again. How are you doing?
Great to be back on, Ali. Yeah, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. It's been a bit of a transition month for me. I've moved away from some writing responsibilities that I had for a while, moving into the TikTok sphere, trying to get some work in the broadcast sphere going. So that's been fun. That's been interesting. But no, I'm good. And yeah, following the Bundesliga this season, working on this season has been incredible. Obviously, yesterday's game was quite something. I didn't imagine that it would happen. The script writers really nailed it yesterday for Leverkusen to come back from 1-0 down in the fashion that they did, and then for Dortmund to win in Munich after what, a decade? Just insane.
For the benefit of the listener, we're recording this bright and early on a beautiful Sunday morning. And yes, yesterday, as Ninad was saying, Bayer Leverkusen came from behind to beat Hoffenheim 2-1, and Dortmund, yeah, in quite a straightforward manner, beat Bayern Munich 2-0 at the Allianz. So the title race probably maybe just about over, but let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Bayer Leverkusen earned the nickname Bayer Leverkusen for a reason, and yeah, we would not want to get too far ahead of ourselves. So looking firstly, Ninad, I guess, at that title race, if we can still call it that after the drama of match day 33, Bayer Leverkusen sit a huge 13 points clear of Bayern Munich. Now, while that lead may seem almost unassailable, Xabi Alonso will be acutely aware that he and his side can ill afford to allow complacency to creep in if they are to banish the demons of 2002 once and for all and secure their first ever Bundesliga title. So, Ninad, who do we think might have the most decisive say in where the Meisterschale will end up at the end of match day 34?
Well, I think Leverkusen have somewhat unexpectedly found themselves in the race this season. At the start of the season, I don't think a lot of people would have said that Bayer Leverkusen would be, far and away front runners for the title and in this race. And so I think the one player who could help them get across the finish line is Victor Boniface. See how I rammed
Beautiful,
it
beautiful. I like it.
there, Ali? So yeah, Victor Boniface. I think, yeah, him coming back from injury, I think is going to be really important for Xabi Alonso. I think in recent weeks we've already seen Leverkusen show some cracks. Obviously in Europe as well against Karabakh, they almost got eliminated and again had to fight back. Patrick Schick has been incredible. I think after the first few weeks of trying to adjust and trying to get his flow back in this team, linking up with the likes of Florian Wirtz, Amin Adli, Nathan Teller, Jeremy Frimpong, all these attackers, they've sort of had to have a readjustment because Boniface and Patrick Schick, such different players. But Schick has found form in the right moment, and now Victor Boniface coming back is all the better for the team because, as we know, he started the season in such great fashion. He has what he has currently speaking, he has 14 goals and 9 assists in the league in Europe. Hasn't started a game since match day 16, obviously, since before the African Cup of Nations. And in his absence, obviously, Patrick Schick has been more or less a de facto starter. And yeah, going back to Boniface's games, in his 15 starts, he had either a goal or assist in 10 of those games. And it just goes to show, how impactful of a player he can be for the team. But it's more than that. I think it's also a question of a stylistic fit. And I think Boniface suits Alonso's style a lot better because you don't want to see you don't want to see someone like Schick dropping into those deeper areas because that's not his cup of tea. It's something that Boniface likes to do. And it's somewhat interestingly, I take this from a scouting football piece by Rahul Iyer. which I highly recommend the listeners to check out. He wrote about how Victor Boniface thinks of himself as a dribbler. And he even said this in an interview, you know, he doesn't look up to the modern day strikers and or you know, he doesn't take inspiration from strikers of old. He looks at the likes of Hatem Ben Arfa and Neymar. And you can see it in his style of play. He's a very, very enjoyable player to watch, very, very exuberant in his dribbling style. And yeah, he's just a thoroughly rounded forward. And for someone like Florian Wirtz, who not only likes to obviously assist goals, but also likes to get on the end of chances himself, I think Boniface is the dream partner. So for Leverkusen to overcome this sort of wobble that they're on, I say wobble, obviously, you know, in terms of results, you can't say it is, but in performances, I think you can make an argument that there has been a slight wobble. To get over that and to finish the season in the strongest way possible, Victor Boniface will be important. So yeah.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Nenad. And as you say, in terms of results, yeah, they've not really wobbled at all. They've shown really impressive resilience, a resilience that perhaps was not demonstrated by Arsenal when they found themselves in a similar position, albeit not quite as far ahead last season in England. And I think, yeah, getting Boniface back after that time away with injury, it is, and it's not like a new signing, that's such a cliche, such a cheap statement to make, but it is like getting that fresh injection of energy, that fresh injection of quality at a really pivotal moment. They've also got that cushion, that 13-point cushion, which is very nice. But I think I think psychologically for Bayer Leverkusen, they will maybe at the back of their minds be thinking about what happened in 2002. They obviously lost the Champions League, the Pokal, and the league all in a very short space of time. And psychologically, while there's probably very few people at the club now who were at the club then, psychologically that can still weigh heavy on a club. And I think they will need everything that they can get their hands on just to ensure that they do get over the line. And maybe they will, I suppose, deliver in style, if you like, over the final few weeks of the season. Wouldn't be too surprised if they were to do that. But I think, yeah, there will be difficult moments, there will be sticky moments, and the likes of Victor Boniface coming back in is so important for them. I suppose that said, Bayern Munich would also need to show real improvement. They looked pretty terrible against Dortmund yesterday. And so, yeah, even if Leverkusen were to slip up once, twice, maybe even three times over the final seven match days, I would be very surprised if Bayern Munich could find a level of consistency to take advantage of those slip-ups, were they or were they not to happen. Turning our attention now, Nenad, to the push for the remaining European spots, failing to qualify for the Champions League would mark another deflating chapter in Borussia Dortmund's really quite frustrating recent history. The Bundesliga may well be afforded a fifth spot in next season's revamped Champions League, but that is not yet guaranteed. So against that backdrop, Dortmund currently find themselves in fourth place, 3 points ahead of Leipzig. But the side from North Rhine-Westphalia have struggled for consistency and at times looked unconvincing this season. And while the same could perhaps previously have been said of Julian Brandt following his move to the Signal Iduna Park back in 2019, it's quite crazy that that's been, yeah, 5 years since that happened. But anyway, the Julian Brandt, the 27-year-old, has arguably stepped up to the plate this time around, having provided six goals and 11 assists across 25 league appearances. So how integral will Brandt be to Dortmund's bid to secure their place in next season's edition of European football's elite club competition, Nenad?
I think he's already showing how integral he's going to be, Ali. I think yesterday's display in the Clásica, I think, just underlines how vital he is to Edin Terzic's team, and yeah, obviously got the assist for Adeyemi's opener. And I think one of the striking things about Brandt is that when he is in his element and when he finds his feet and when he's in that sort of run of form where he has no sort of dips in his sort of displays, Brand always gives you an 8 out of 10 performance, and he's a very, very smart, very, very smart footballer. And He gives you solutions in so many different positions. He can play attacking midfield. He can play left wing. He can play center midfield. He also played defensive midfield against Hoffenheim alongside Marcel Sabitzer. So this is a player that is whose sort of football IQ is in a level above the rest. And the fact that he is still just 27, I took a step back. I thought he was around 29 or 30 because I think he's shown a sort of maturity this season that Dortmund will need, obviously, in terms of the finish line this season, but even going forward, because as we know, Marco Reus is coming to the end of his time at the club now, and I think the club will be looking to someone to sort of be that next torchbearer for the, for the upcoming generation, the likes of Adeyemi and Malen, Bynoe-Gittens, Paris Bruna, the youngster who's coming through from the academy. You have all these talents, and Julian Brandt is someone who sort of ties it all together. I think I call him the cement between the bricks of Dortmund's team. He sort of, yeah, just has he's done it all for them this season, I think. And Nagelsmann himself said, Brandt was close to a call, but it's just that Kjus Furyk's form was so impressive that he couldn't be ignored. But yeah, I think Brandt is always going to be in the conversation of one of the smartest players in the league. Brings so much to the table in terms of his passing, in terms of his link play, in terms of his movement of the ball, works hard out of possession as well. Just ticks so many boxes. And it's a shame that, his career hasn't seen a league title because I think it deserves more. And I do hope that Dortmund can somehow eventually become that team for him to have that sort of involvement in a title race, because I think a player of that quality sort of deserves that. But yeah, I think since Jadon Sancho's come back, what's been interesting for me is how Brandt has sort of moved into a deeper role in midfield, because otherwise he was far more involved offensively. And that's where he got most of his assists, isn't it? He got most of his assists and goals in the first half of the season. Now, second half, he's dropped back a little bit more, but there's been no drop off in sort of his performances and his level of displays. And harking back to what I said earlier, just a very smart footballer who is going to play a pivotal role in how Borussia Dortmund transition in the next couple of years into either a title challenging side or a team that just consolidates themselves in European competition every season. I hope it's the former. We'll see.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. They're a very intelligent football player, and maybe I'm being harsh here, but I find him quite frustrating. Not so much this season because, as we were saying, he has stepped up to the plate, but one of these players who, yeah, very intelligent, can really influence a game, but quite often, not this season, but in previous seasons, just could not quite find that consistency. He would look brilliant in patches. He would look quite anonymous in patches as well. Whereas this season, he does seem to have found a bit of consistency. And yeah, I mean, Dortmund themselves have been as inconsistent as ever. They've been as frustrating as ever. But I think what we've seen from Julian Brandt is a player stepping up to the plate. And as you say, maybe Nenad, he is aware of the increasingly important role he will have to play in leading, I suppose, this Dortmund side over the next few years. And I think Dortmund on the whole, interestingly enough, I mean, it's just not an option for them not to qualify for the Champions League, really. And but I think Dortmund on the whole will look at how poor Bayern have been this season. They'll look at how good Bayer Leverkusen have been this season, and they'll view it as a real missed opportunity because they've fluffed their lines on several occasions. They've missed several opportunities. Had they been at a higher level this season, that could have been them rather than Bayer Leverkusen and Xabi Alonso sitting top of the table, looking well positioned to break Bayern Munich's dominance. Okay, looking now at the foot of the table, Nenad, Darmstadt and Köln currently occupy the automatic relegation places, whilst Mainz find themselves in the relegation playoff spot. Crucially for Mainz, however, their 23-year-old forward, Jonathan Burkhardt, has found a run of form and fitness at just the right moment. Could he be the man to almost single-handedly drag Bo Henriksen's side up the table and clear of the relegation dogfight?
He could be, and I'll tell you, Ali, he's been single-handedly responsible for some of Mainz's best results in recent weeks. Obviously, scoring twice in a 2-0 win against Bochum very recently. Scored the only goal they had against Gladbach in a 1-1 draw, and yeah, I think Jonathan Burkhardt is one of these players who's always going to excite whenever he's on the pitch. He's very direct. He's very hard to contain, and somewhat surprisingly, I was just looking at his profile on Football Reference. He's in his sixth Bundesliga season now. For a 23-year-old, he hasn't played a lot of minutes in these 6 seasons, obviously owing to injuries and strikers being above him in the pecking order. I think this season, for the rest of the campaign at least, he's going to be the guy that Bo Henriksen and his team will look to drag them out of sticky situations, because they've also added to their sort of firepower now. Obviously, they always had Karim Onisivo, but now they've got Ludovic Ajok, who, despite not offering as many goals as you would expect of him, I think him and Onisivo will offer Burkhardt that platform and occupy defenders in a way that Burkhardt can then access those channels, access space from behind, and he's already doing that so far. Obviously, 4 goals since coming back from his long-term injury. And it's those injuries that have held him back in recent years, because otherwise this is a very, very outstanding player. Obviously, Germany youth captain, former youth captain, I should say. And yeah, I think you look at the quotes from Mainz sporting director and manager himself, Bo Henriksen, Martin Schmidt, the sporting director, saying that it's outstanding that a young guy like Jonathan Burkhardt is taking responsibility in this situation almost after his long-term injury. And Henriksen as well, saying Johnny's not afraid of anything. That is what we need in our situation. And this is the crucial bit. I think Mainz are going to have to sort of accept the fact that they will probably have to be in that playoff spot and have to battle someone from the Zweite Bundesliga to fight for their status. And to their credit, I think they've done some really smart business in the January window. Most importantly, bringing in someone like Nadim Amiri, who I think has been excellent since he's had this regular spell of games that he didn't have at Bayer Leverkusen. And I think they've done all the right things that they could have done so far. Bo Henriksen is this very magnanimous personality, very charming, very positive and full of energy. Obviously, I work with the league, and we get clips of them, and we get access to all this in behind the scenes footage. And yeah, it's incredible to see the kind of positive energy that he's brought to the team, which I think is exactly what they needed. And Burkhardt himself called him a timely lifeline almost to this season. So yeah, I think coming back to Burkhardt himself, I think yeah, just a thoroughly exciting footballer. I think he's going to get a few more goals before the end of the season. And in another universe, Ali, I think he could have been the striker for Germany heading into the Euros. But we'll save that conversation for another day. Who knows? Maybe it'll be the 26th World Cup where he can, shine. But for now, I think he can be the guy that saves Mainz and their Bundesliga status.
Yeah, he looks well positioned to author a positive storyline for Mainz. I've always enjoyed watching Burkhardt play. He's obviously been unfortunate in the sense that he's not had his injuries to seek. But I think if he can stay fit next season, if Mainz can stay up, whether or not Burkhardt is still at Mainz next season remains to be seen. But yeah, he's the sort of player that when you watch him again, it comes back to that intelligence, the intelligence of movement, and yeah, a good finisher. The sort of player who, even at the age of 23, looks like he could be the leader, looks like he could be the player to, yeah, single-handedly drag Mainz clear of the relegation dogfight. Okay, we are going to draw our analysis of the Bundesliga to a close there. I'm going to thank Ninad for your time on this lovely Sunday morning. We'll be back very shortly to look at the latest goings on in Spain. We'll be right back. In Spain, we are faced with the somewhat unusual prospect of a Copa del Rey final in which neither of our finalists come from the big three, and neither have won the competition in the last 2 decades. We've spoken about the semi-finals previously, but what are some of the storylines and details to look out for on Saturday night in Sevilla as Athletic Club and Real Mallorca do battle, Barlow?
Yeah, I mean, Athletic Club have not won this competition in 40 years. It's 4 decades this year, and I think for Athletic, and this would be kind of the crowning glory for Ernesto Valverde. I mean, he's now in his third spell. In each of his previous two spells, he's been brilliant for Athletic, getting him into Europe, getting him into the Champions League for the first time in a long time, and he has a shot at doing that again this season. But winning that major trophy, having that celebration, I think, is the thing that most Athletic sales are really desiring. You listen to some of the people, some of the players this week have already been started speaking, and Danny Vivian, the centre half, saying that this is the game of our lives. The Williams brothers saying that they've dreamed of this since they were kids, of getting to a Copa del Rey final and together and winning it, lifting that trophy. It's been a long old wait, and for Athletic, who are historically one of the most successful clubs in La Liga, we know that they're one of the three clubs that have never been relegated. We know they've got a good record in the cup, but yeah, 40 years, that's several generations that have never seen them lift a major trophy. They did win the Super Cup back in about 2016-17 with Ernesto Valverde, but it's not quite the same when you're playing two games to get there. So yeah, I think a huge game for the Athletic. I think this will define a generation one way or another, because even though they've been in five previous finals in recent years, all of those finals were against kind of Barcelona, Real Madrid, big teams that they don't expect to necessarily beat. Whereas against Mallorca, this is a golden opportunity in a sense. You look at the players in that Athletic side. Iker Muniain is a little bit younger, but potentially his last season. He's obviously been there a long, long time, came through at the age of 16, about 15 years already. He's been in the side. He's the captain, and there's five players in that squad who are 33 or over. You look at them, you think, is this maybe their last shot at glory with Athletic? Óscar de Marcos, who's been around for a long time. We were just mentioning Bielsa before. He kind of really came to prominence under Bielsa. Raúl García, who is, yeah, he's been a mainstay of La Liga for as long as I can remember. Danny Garcia, and Herrera, of course, people will be aware of from his time in England. Yuri Bacicci, former PSG left back. A lot of these players are kind of getting towards the crest of the end of their careers, and this would be some way to either sign off or to certainly crown the end of their careers. And Nico Williams as well, you wonder, I mean, he's got a 50 million release clause. Could this be the last time that he has a chance to lift a trophy with Athletic? Certainly, there'll be teams interested in him. The partnership of him and Iñaki has been one of the most joyous parts of Spanish football in the last 2 seasons, especially. But yeah, they've just been on fire all year. You look at Gorka Guruceta, who's the striker. We mentioned him a couple of weeks ago as well. And yeah, he's nicknamed Benzema for the kind of impact that he's had in the way that he plays and moves for this side. There's a lot to like about this Athletic Club, and even Dani Vivian and Aitor Paredes, I should mention as well. Vivian capped by Spain last week, and should be possibly one of their best defenders for the next kind of decade as well. So there's a lot to like about an Athletic side. They go up against a Mallorca who, again, kind of underdogs and quite lovable in many respects. I mean, I've spoken pretty highly of Javier Aguirre in the past kind of year or so. We're in year 28 of his career. He's never won a title in Europe. There's uncertainty of his over his future. He's been linked with a return to the Mexico job, so he could be off at the end of the season. Sergi Darder, I think we've mentioned before as well, somebody that Sid Lowe's done a lot of or a few articles with, and he's been very open about kind of depression, his mental battles in the past, and he's returned home last summer to kind of have this glorious homecoming. He grew up just a few miles outside of La Palma in Mallorca, and for him to come home and to lift the Copa del Rey would be a pretty insane story. Having left home so young, it's well, yeah, not quite, but verging on 20 years since he left and has returned. He scored the winning penalty in that semi-final, and it was yeah, you could see the kind of tension and the nerves on his face. He could lift the cup. Dominic Greif, who's the goalkeeper, was the hero in that semi-final, saved a penalty in normal time from Brais Mendes, and then saved Mikel Oyarzabal's penalty in the penalty shootout. You listen to the way Aguirre speaks about him, He's pretty damning. He said when we got here, he was broken, he was limping around, he was destroyed, he was kind of this desolate shell of a footballer. And yet now he's got the chance to be this huge hero in Mallorca. Everybody knows his name. He's the backup goalkeeper, but he's been playing throughout the cup run. And finally for Mallorca, Toni Rayo and Abdon Prats, who both mustachioed, hardworking. They went down into the third tier with Mallorca, not necessarily the most kind of technically gifted of players or players that you would necessarily put as kind of the most talented in their side, but quite impressive the way that they've worked and gone right all the way from the third division up to Primera, got relegated again, went back up again, and now they have the chance to really put the icing on the cake of their Mallorca careers, both in their 30s now as well. And you look at kind of the Copa del Rey. Since Getafe got to the final in 2008, it's only Alaves who have really been sort of vast underdogs, teams that shouldn't really be getting there. And you sort of wonder, are these teams kind of losing the ability to dream in the cup? You see the likes of England, France, I think Serie A, we mentioned it previously as well. Majority of these cup winners are kind of league winners. And apart from Alaves, I think all of them in the last 15 years have won the league at some stage in their history, Athletic included. And so for Mallorca to get there, it is a real outside punt and a real chance at a proper underdog story, even if they have won the Copa del Rey more recently in an Athletic in 2003, and that was Samietto and probably their most glorious moment, and a chance to write this kind of most glorious chapter in the history. Because I think even though Samuel Eto'o is probably and his kind of era, that's probably the high point of them as a team in terms of quality. This would be a much more of an underdog story, and with players like Abdon Prats, Ferhat Morici, players that are lovable and hardworking, but not necessarily at that top level. So it's going to be a fascinating watch. It's going to be late in Seville. There's going to be, I think, a big long day of drinking and partying for the fans, and then at the end of it, one of them is going to be absolutely desolate, and one of them is going to be overjoyed having done something that will be remembered forever in their region. So yeah. Bring it on.
I'll be tabs on it for the redemption arc of Morici alone. But last week we had the news that Yagoba Arasate would be leaving Osasuna after 6 years in charge. He earned plenty of due praise last season, taking Osasuna to the Copa del Rey final himself. But less than 12 months later, an apparently harmonious relationship is ending. Tell us more, Barlow.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, kind of just about 12 months on from getting Osasuna to the final, one of their greatest runs ever, one of the best Osasuna sides that there's been in recent years and in quite a long time. And he took up Osasuna up as Segunda winners back in its first season in the 2017-18 season, and it was. And since then, finished 10th, 11th, 10th, and 7th, and they're on course for a top half finish again this season. Last year, when they got to the Copa del Rey final, that was their first qualification for Europe since 2008. So again, kind of 15 years or so ago. And Arasate's run at Osasuna has been one of the best stories and one of the more impressive stories that has been, because it's an Osasuna side that 10 years ago were really in the mire and looked as if they could go bankrupt. I mean, we spoke about it previously last season, and when I went up to kind of Pamplona and spoke to the president, and they were saying that he was basically maxing out his credit cards at one point to keep the club afloat and to keep the club being able to keep the lights on. So yeah, they had kind of a really impressive grand rise to where they are now, which is one of the most sustainable and best run clubs in La Liga. But yeah, they came from the depths, and Arrasate is a huge, huge part of that story. I think there's a local feel to Arasate. He mentioned kind of tiredness, and he mentioned that Osasuna wanted to renew him, but it was kind of more of a footballing decision. Braulio Vasquez, the sporting director, and Luis Sabalza, the president, both very passionate, and you could see Sabalza was almost in tears in his farewell press conference, and Arasate was in tears. But yeah, I think he's a guy that really moved Pamplona and really felt like part of the club. He moved there, he had his family there. There's kind of videos from the past where he would be sat in the square with Osasuna fans having a drink after games and stuff, and just really kind of, yeah, part of the community. And people felt that he was one of them, despite the fact that he started off at Real Sociedad. He Arrasate, this is called it, the most beautiful period in his life. He remarked that I won't find another club like this. I won't find another support like this. I'm delighted to be here, but I also have to be honest. And I think it's the time. And I think it's best not to draw things out. The phrase that he actually used was estirar el chicle, which literally means to kind of draw out the chewing gum and kind of chew the chewing gum too much and until it's kind of lost its flavor. So yeah, it kind of comes with a sadness for me, and maybe I'm kind of projecting too much onto this because I like Arrasate and I think that they've had a really good match there. But yeah, it's so rare when you get things right at a football club, and you look at the teams in La Liga now. I think I counted about five or six of these clubs that at any one time are kind of happy with they are. They're happy with how the club's doing, the direction they're going, and for 5 6 years also soon have been at club every season. And save halfway through one when it looked like they were going to get relegated, and Arrasate managed to turn things around. It's really been a run of kind of harmony, and that kind of harmonious period at a football club, it doesn't last long. It doesn't tend to be there for a long time. And you so both know from your supports and your kind of allegiances that when the going is good, it's rarely good for long. And this has been a long period of that for Osasuna. So what comes next is the still got the structure in place. There's going to be uncertainty though, and you never know whether you're going to get it right with that appointment. And so it's, yeah, there's certainly an element of sadness tinged with it for me at least, seeing kind of a glorious era in some senses come to an end.
Well, sorry to hear that, Barlo, but finally you've been speaking to some of the main characters at Las Palmas recently, including Starlet Alberto Malero and sporting director Luis Helguera recently. Being in the Canary Islands, a blob in the ocean in their words, not mine, it's bound to be a unique club anyway, but you encountered a slightly logical, albeit disconcerting, story.
Yeah, they were good fun to talk to, it has to be said. Those were the words of Patrizio Vignaio, who is the general director, and yeah, he was an interesting character. Actually, just speaking to him, he was talking about, he used to be a journalist back in the day, so I was kind of speaking to him and saying, well, you used to be a journalist, now you're inside the football club, what is it that we kind of do wrong? And the kind of main thing that he was explaining or kind of talking about was basically the emotional versus the rational, and how football at its heart in journalism or in business, and in his case in kind of managing the club, it's basically kind of reacting to the emotional, which is what your heart's doing, and the logical and the rational. And the rational for them, and it's something that Luis Helguera, as you mentioned, the sporting director, was very upfront about, was basically, we are a selling club. We exist to platform these players, these coaches, these staff members, to give them a chance to kind of really exprime, that's a very Spanish word, extract their talent. And kind of get that out there, put them on a platform, and then go and kind of conquer the world elsewhere. And that kind of honesty was really quite surprising, because normally you get clubs that will be selling clubs in essence, or to a degree will look to kind of finance their club through sales and stuff. But the openness to admit that and the kind of honesty of that is really kind of quite rare, because mostly fans, yeah, myself included, you don't want to hear that you're a stepping stone to something else. But the way they kind of phrased it and the way they put it was that, yeah, Las Palmas and the Canary Islands will be great by the likes of Pedri, by the likes of Alberto Malero, as I'll come on to, kind of making a name for themselves abroad by kind of taking that classic kind of Canary Islands style with them. And you see it with Pedri, you see it with Malero, the way that they touch the ball, the way they get on the ball. Jonathan Vieira, who's probably not too well known outside of Spain, but within Spain, he's a really kind of interesting character, but also really fascinating footballer to watch. He's just so technically gifted. And for, as they were saying, a tiny blob in the island and a tiny kind of population, essentially, they do a lot for football, and they bring through a lot of footballers. And Pedro Rodriguez, former Chelsea player, Barcelona player, of course, that part of that great Pep Guardiola team, he was part of it as well. And the relationship that they have with the ball, the desire to kind of play football and play kind of a quite ambitious style, as we kind of mentioned a few weeks ago again when we were talking about them against Getafe. And yeah, to be so kind of upfront about that and kind of honest about where the club is and where they are going was quite interesting for me. And I thought It's a different take, and especially the way they were talking about it, saying as well how they obviously have their style. They look to be kind of a very kind of possession-based style. They like to get on the ball, touch it, pass it around, control the game in that sense. But they're looking at the likes of RB Leipzig. They're looking at the likes of kind of these Manchester City, the all these different kind of bigger teams to see what they can incorporate into their style. And they were saying that, yeah, look, if the market needs bigger fullbacks, if the market needs a more direct kind of player or a player that is able to play on the counter attack, able to move the ball kind of quickly through midfield, then that's what we'll look to provide. That's what we'll look to incorporate, because ultimately the market is king. So yeah, I thought that that was an interesting little detail. And yeah, on that note, I will leave that detail with you. And apart from that, Alberto Moleiro as well, very ambitious, keen to make a name for himself, I think. He's very keen to say that I like the comparisons with Pedri because he's a great player, but I'm different. I'm my own guy. And certainly one to keep an eye on. He very nearly scored an equaliser against Barcelona the weekend. And for a long time was linked with the biggest clubs. So yeah, keep an eye on Moleiro because he's a very, very kind of confident, without being arrogant, and technically gifted footballer.
Lovely stuff, Barlow. Insightful and enlightening, as always. Yeah, keen to see how Las Palmas fare over the remainder of the season. Okay, I think on that note, I will say to you, Rudy Barlow, go and enjoy Granada. I'll say to you, Michael Jones, thank you very much for your contributions earlier in the episode. And I will say thank you to you, the listener, for your continued support. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time for what will be our 99th episode, believe it or not. Until then, stay safe and stay well. Goodbye.